Those of you on the beach with a Stephen King novel rather than the latest work of a literary novelist will be heartened by an article in the current issue of The Atlantic titled A Reader's Manifesto. Its target is America's current crop of literary writers. NPR's Renee Montaigne spoke with author B.R. Myers, who believes many of today's prize-winning novels are unreadable.
Brian R. Myers is not a critic. In fact, he's never published criticism before. His manifesto is the work of a reader who sees himself hungry for a well-told tale at a banquet serving mostly literary pretension. Faced with the work of today's literati, he writes, "Give me a time-tested masterpiece, or what critics patronizingly call a fun read, Sister Carrie, or just plain Carrie." The article is causing a stir in a number of literary chat rooms. In it, the reader, Myers, takes on several American writers who are far more used to praise and prizes. For example, Cormac McCarthy and his novel, All the Pretty Horses.
This is a passage in which Cormac McCarthy is describing a hangover that the cowboys are going through. And it's described in an extraordinarily epic prose. "They walked off in separate directions through the chaparral to stand spraddle-legged, clutching their knees and vomiting. The browsing horses jerked their heads up. It was no sound they'd ever heard before. In the gray twilight, those retchings seemed to echo like the calls of some rude provisional species loosed upon that waste. Something imperfect and malformed lodged in the heart of being. A thing smirking deep in the eyes of grace itself, like a gorgon in an autumn pool."
And you pretty much write where to begin.
Well, my whole point was that you can't understand what he's saying, for one thing, which is considered a good thing these days. I saw a novel recently that was praised on the front cover for being impossible to decipher fully. But when I read an excerpt like that, I have no idea what the thing smirking deep in the eyes of grace itself is, what something imperfect and malformed refers to. I don't know whether the gorgon is in the pool or whether it's smirking into the pool. And I don't think that McCarthy could explain it either. I think he wrote that excerpt simply because he liked the way it sounded, okay? In 1982, Don DeLillo published a novel called The Names, and the narrator of this novel is an American based in Greece who routinely lies to his concierge about where he's traveling. He says he's going to England, but then he really goes to Japan, and so on. Now, the narrator tries to tell us, in all seriousness, that these little deceptions raise grave philosophical questions, and I quote, "What was I tampering with? The human faith in naming? The lifelong system of images in Nico's brain?" End of quote. Now, let's talk about this for a second. If I tell your listeners right now that I'm flying to Canada tonight, but in fact I fly to Mexico, then I'm not tampering with a system of names and images in anyone's brain. Even if they know where I'm really going, they'll just conclude that I'm a liar. But it gets worse, and I quote, "The lie was deeper in Greek than it would have been in English. I knew this without knowing why. Could reality be phonetic, a matter of gutturals and dentals?" So we jump from a silly premise to an even sillier conclusion, though DeLillo covers himself by phrasing things in the form of a rhetorical question. Now, what gets me angry is when I look at the front of the book and I see Newsday praising it as an ambitious novel of ideas. Now, I imagine college kids having to read this book in class and thinking they must be too stupid to enjoy an ambitious novel of ideas because they don't have a clue what DeLillo is saying. And the truth is, those kids will be the smart ones, the ones who are reading closely.
Well, I will say, and let me pose something that I think is a fair concern, and that's if you were to look at 4 square inches of Jackson Pollock and you were to place it next to Vermeer, and then you were to say that those drips are horrible compared to those exquisite brush strokes of Vermeer, you would be missing a couple of really important things. One, the total effect of the entire work, the whole painting or the body of painting. You'd also be missing how Pollock cracked open another way of looking at things. And those are pretty important. And there would be those who might argue that, say, Cormac McCarthy, he may look bad in your article, what you chose to pull out, but he accomplished those things. What do you say to something like that?
Sure. Of course, you know, literary scholarship always likes to say that you can't use excerpts when you're discussing a work. But this concern is always raised when you're criticizing a writer's style. It's never raised when you're using an excerpt to praise a writer. In any case, far from looking for the worst bits I could find, I deliberately looked for excerpts which the New York Times and the Washington Post and other sources had already praised to the public as examples of great writing. And this was the case for most of the lengthy excerpts in the article. But precisely because critics and prize jurors are looking at each individual sentence in isolation, they're looking for the flashy sentences that they can put in their excerpt box, they miss this larger point. So that's a charge. The charge that you raise is one that I could bring against them just as well.
Do you imagine that the readers of your manifesto will be tittering and saying, finally, someone is saying out loud what I've long suspected, that literary critics and serious authors these days are, in a sense, selling us a bill of goods?
Well, this is the reaction that I've got so far. But at the same time, an awful lot of people seem to be really offended by the piece.
What are they saying to
you?
Well,
a lot of the online criticism is on a schoolyard level. You know, he's just jealous and who does he think he is and so on. On the other hand, a lot of the outrage over the piece comes from a double standard in literary criticism. It's considered okay to mock popular writers like Tom Clancy and Jackie Collins, but to use even a mildly disrespectful tone when you're discussing a so-called literary novelist is just unacceptable to many people.
Hmm. But what about you? Of course, it's sort of proudly presented as a reader's manifesto, not a critic's manifesto, not a writer's manifesto. Are you spitting in the wind, in a way? You can't make a difference.
Well, there is a snobbery at issue here. The postmodern gang, these writers today, they can boast all they want about collapsing the boundaries between high and low culture. But what they've done is precisely the opposite. They have taken the literary novel, which in the days of Dickens and Stevenson and Kipling really did unite high and low culture, and they've made it into the most exclusive, most elite form of literary expression around. And what's more, they're perfectly happy with this. On the other hand, Lu Xun, a Chinese writer, said once that fiction could bring about the spiritual transformation of the people. Now, that may be a naive hope, but wouldn't it be nice if an American writer said something like that for a change? So, to answer your question, I don't believe that I'm going to change things overnight, and I don't believe that this article is going to have any effect at all on these writers' reputations, but I think it's going to get some people thinking.
B.R. Meyer's Reader's Manifesto can be found in the current issue of The Atlantic. I'm Renee Montaigne, NPR News.